Hello, this is Monocle Reads and I'm Georgina Godwin, and today I'm asking questions of Dr. Rahul Jandial, who can be more commonly found dissecting what we think rather than the other way around. Dr. Rahul Jandial, thank you so much for joining me here on Monocle Reads. Your book, Life Lessons from a Brain Surgeon, is incredibly helpful to people, but it's also beautifully written. This is not a textbook that we get lost in. It's wonderful stories, and you engage us in real plot as well as giving us guidance on the best way to be who we are.
Thank you for inviting me. And the stories is one way for me to establish credibility, because how dare I speak to you about your brain, about the human brain, the most complex thing in the universe. So the stories show the journey in the last 15 years of becoming a brain surgeon, becoming a brain scientist, having some triumphs, having some tragedy, and then trying to put that together. I wanted to wait till I had a bit of grit and gravitas before I shared these stories and what they mean, as well as include modern science in an understandable way so people aren't manipulated by the fads and the things that are being peddled commonly in the wellness industry.
Because there is so much nonsense, isn't there?
And there's a strange elitism to it, that the meditation or healthy eating, that you have to buy it. It's advantageous to have affluence because you have access to these things. When I say the opposite, that we have a toolkit within us to make our lives better, that's free. And so that's also highlighted in the book.
I want to go back to stories and talk about your own personal story. Mm. Where did it start for you? Were you born in Los Angeles?
No, actually, I was born in Kashmir. When we had the opportunity to leave, we did. It was a violent area. And when my father had the opportunity to come to the States, we went to Los Angeles. And I remember people ask me, well, where are you from? I tell them I'm from Los Angeles Airport, LAX. It's the sort of the portal and the nexus for me connecting to so many different parts of the world. And I love to travel, and I do it mostly for pleasure, and I do children's brain surgery in other countries, and now my life in London. But LAX is interesting to me because Los Angeles is my home, and I love it. And it's so much more than Hollywood. There are 20 million people there, and 19.9 are not in the industry. And so I grew up there with universities, with freeways, with rap culture, with snowboarding, with surfing. It was just, it's a vibrant place, and it's a massive place. I was never studious. I was able to get the marks, but I never applied myself. So much so when I got to university, I dropped out for 2 years and I was working as a security guard. It was a bit of self-reflection because I realized I am interested in something. Don't get me wrong, I have ambition. It's just not about reading textbooks. I wanted to learn about human nature. And at that age, about 19, my mother developed breast cancer. She's fine. She's living with me now. And I was volunteering at San Francisco General at the origin of the AIDS epidemic. And there's just so much life up and down, left and right, in every dimension. And I thought, the hospital will be my workspace, because in one building, you have MD, PhDs, and you have people in crisis, you have technicians. In L.A., gangs came in and shot doctors in the 90s in the hospital. They were metal detectors. I thought, this is a wild place with breadth and depth, and I want to help people, but I also saw the opportunity that providing care would let me understand myself. So I've opened 5,000 skulls, over 5,000 skulls, and I've met over 25,000 people in clinics through this journey now at the age of 47. And what a rare opportunity to understand human nature. That was my drive. And that's what I share in this book, are insights from that journey. Mm. And delighted to have it be a success in London unexpectedly.
Well, but I mean, it is extraordinary from somebody who doesn't want to read textbooks, who's working as a security guard. So how many books have you written now? Textbooks have you contributed to?
Well, I don't know how that happened either. But once I had the rare opportunity to become a brain surgeon, I wanted to contribute. And so I have published over 100 academic papers and 10 textbooks. And one of them has gone to second edition. So if people understand books, that means people are liking it. And that there's a strange opportunity to be immortal, that I might be able to have a book that teaches the future generations of brain surgeons in training. So that's powerful. This one is equally powerful because there are different topics in here: sleep, creativity, aging. So different people are finding it useful in different ways. And the fact that I was able to have this opportunity was off of actually some TV exposure. I did some television in the States. Then I signed with an agency. The agency had a literary agency. I said, let me talk to them. I've got something for them. And I had been preparing these stories in the back of my mind more as just bibliotherapy for myself to reflect on what I had been seeing, doing, experiencing. And so that book was picked up and we wrote it. The editors were great. It didn't do well in the States. But Penguin UK had also bought the book, the manuscript, and they changed the cover design. They changed the title, which I didn't know was possible, which was, you know, I'm just learning. I'm still learning about this. And I come here last summer with my son and think, I am on top of the world. I have a book tour in London. How does it get better? And after a couple of interviews and a couple of things, when I landed at LAX, again, home, LAX, my portal to the world, it said, you are officially a Sunday Times bestselling author. And I just thought, oh my gosh, my life has changed. I changed the way I saw myself. It's been that powerful for me. And I'm very grateful to Britain.
But you're also changing the way that we live our lives.
That's my intention, without being judgmental. It doesn't matter what you do, actually. The freedom to make your own decisions is a great liberty. I just want people to be empowered by knowledge that we have actually known for decades. It's not like last year's cutting-edge science. A lot of the information is from decades of knowledge in brain surgery and brain science that we have failed to explain. We know so much about the heart. We know our joints, our skin, our hair. Yet we don't know about ourselves. The unlimited potential, yet the laws and the rules that govern us as well. And I always tell people, we are from atomic dust. And the example I give is the electrical and the electrochemistry in our brains can be detected. You can put a sticker on a forehead and measure the electricity, the oscillations. You can take an antidepressant and change serotonin in our brains. And interestingly, World Health Organization essential medicine for bipolar disorder is lithium. It's an ion on the periodic table. It's a part of batteries, yet it can also change our moods and thoughts. That's how connected we are with nature. So there are rules that govern our biology and our behavior. And then when you really understand that, you come away, I hope, thinking, I am new every day. There is no triumph or tragedy that is lasting. And that I can think and I can feel and I can dial that ratio. If I'm under threat, I can rely on my instinctive, visceral mind. If my threat is inappropriate because I'm stressed out just on the subway or freeway, I can think that stress down. That complexity, that duality, that nuance is what I want people to walk away with. Not the simple fixes like, oh, you have an emotional mind or intelligent mind. Or this is where creativity lives. It's not that simple. And that simplicity has made us see ourselves in a limited light. I think when people see the stories in this book, they will realize that we have tremendous potential to be a better version of ourselves.
How?
Well, a lot of different ways. So if you want to talk about staving off dementia, we have some information on that. If you want to talk about creativity, sleep may be a portal to that. And so I would ask you, which one do you want to tackle first?
Dementia and creativity, both.
Yeah. Dementia is interesting because it affects the flesh, so anatomy. It affects the cells, neurons, the building blocks, if you will. If there's a sand castle, each grain of sand would be the cells. And then it affects the electrochemistry. We don't have a pill for it, despite people's efforts. Because it's not like unclogging a heart artery. It's a complicated undertaking. Yet there is a prevention strategy for it that has been proven effective over thousands of patients in many countries. And that's just changing what you eat, not how much you eat. We're not talking about weight loss. I don't get into that. But what you eat is called the mind diet. And it's basically the Mediterranean diet, olive oil, nuts, mostly plants, occasional fatty fish, some red wine, that if you make that change now, because it's delicious, it doesn't feel arduous, which is also fantastic, that you will, over the next decade or two in a glacial way, put yourself in a much lower risk of dementia. Whatever your dementia or individual risk is that we don't even know yet, right? Because we can't predict the future. You will put yourself in a healthier aging bucket. And that's a simple and powerful thing that we can do. That doesn't have to be arduous. Mm. Yet many people don't know that. And there are powerful studies about that. The other thing with dementia is being vertical. And when I say vertical, I mean we sit too much. And the body changes when we stand and walk. The brain will shower itself with BDNF, nerve growth factor, sort of fertilizer for our cognitive ecosystem. Just by walking. You don't have to become a marathoner. Going from sitting to walking will get you 80% of that yield. And so these simple steps are our best approach to preventing dementia. And the last thing is for dementia, the third tip would be we are thinking flesh. If we wanted to run faster, we know what to do, right? We train. Thinking flesh means we should think. And I don't mean in an intellectual way. We should just learn new things as a habit. A different magazine, a different route home, a couple times a week. You have to get the things done of your daily life. You know, I'm not suggesting wander aimlessly. But just to bring in the process of learning is brain training. You don't have to buy it. And so it's not about actually becoming bilingual. It's the process of trying to become bilingual, even if you're miserable at it. The trying to learn new words, reading different languages, the effort is what stimulates the brain. So those would be my three things that I would say about dementia. And they're in the book, of course, but they've been out there for decades. Yet we haven't translated it in a way that people can understand. Change what you eat. Walk briskly a couple of times a week. Do a few fun things that are new and different. That's the easiest free prescription that anybody can have and the most powerful method to stave off dementia. That is proven across rigorous science and studies. Yet it's not packaged well and we don't see it enough. We tend to hear superfood, eat one blueberry and your brain will be fine. And if you think about the complexity that I've shared, the solution should be also balanced. The ecosystem cannot be tuned with the inclusion of one food or the exclusion of one food. It's mind diet, walking, thinking and learning a few things. That's your best shot. And you know what? That sounds like a good life as well.
Absolutely. What about creativity then?
This is a topic dear to me. I like surgery because it is sculpting. The best among us are sculptors. You're not doing the same 10,000 steps. It's not changing an engine. Some people grab the tissue lightly with their forceps. Some people can spread once and anatomy will reveal itself while others have to snip, snip, snip. So the best among us are efficient and fluid in the way that the planes and the valleys inside the brain are parted. And I look at that as a creative endeavor. If you looked at our tools, you would say, hey, wait a second. There's sewing instruments, there's chisels and sculpting instruments, blades. It's a creative endeavor, and I love it. So rather than revealing a statue out of a block of marble as a cancer surgeon, I'm trying to remove the cancer from the statue, if you will. What's the least disruptive way to slide in, shell out a cancer, and leave the patient whole? To me, that's a creative endeavor. My other half of my life is science, thinking about Mother Nature. We don't get cures from the Amazon as much as we used to. We have to invent medicine, much like somebody would invent a phone or a Mars rover. So that takes being inventive. So I feel like my life, to achieve in it, I have relied on creativity. And it has now become very popular as the goal for many people, especially high-achieving people. And so it's a little bit of a deep dive, if you don't mind, because there's no simple answer to this. But first, I would offer some examples about hidden creativity in all of us. We know about savant syndromes, people who get struck by lightning and all of a sudden they have some rare abilities. We know that patients who have dementia, tying it back, sometimes when their frontal lobes wither and you lose that executive function, which is important to live your life and live your day, they have dramatic improvements in their ability to paint. This is in the literature. Well, how does that? You get dementia, but now you can paint better? That's true. That's searchable on rigorous websites. So those examples were exciting to me. Some people think microdosing and psychedelics might help them have more creative ideas, but we don't want to rely on drugs. Children are creative. Their frontal lobes are not fully developed. in our sleep, we are wildly creative. It's within us when the frontal lobes get out of the way. So our executive function that helps us get efficiently through the day is tamping down some of the creative ability. So how do we harness that? How do we tap into it reliably for a career or as a habit? What I found was very interesting that Salvador Dali wrote a book on craftsmanship, and he relied on the portal to sleep, he called it. Thomas Edison used to leave a notepad and have his chair balanced on the back two legs. And the minute he'd fall asleep, the thoughts he was having, he would jot down. The movie Inception with Leonardo DiCaprio and Tom Hardy has that in there, how they pull him out of the dream states is falling backwards. That's based on Thomas Edison's process for creativity. But that's a bit not grounded in science for me. And so now we know that there is a period, hypnagogic and hypnopompic, that going from awake to asleep and asleep to awake, there are these 15, about, you know, the windows, we're not machines, but that transition is a time when you are sliding into sleep, but awake enough to remember what you're thinking about. And so what I do for a complex tumor that I'm going to have to tackle the next day, or a riddle that I haven't been able to solve thinking about Mother Nature for my science lab, is I clear my mind as much as I can. The emails are sent, the lights are off, the doors are locked, kids are in bed, teenage boys, they don't have to tuck them in anymore. But I use that time to let that float in my mind. And then when I get up, I'm thinking about it often, and I write down some thoughts that I'm having. And what I will tell you is most of those thoughts are not constructive or creative. But when I have had good, creative, interesting thoughts, it has come through that process. So the portal to sleep might be one way for us to harness our creativity. And it's, again, it's free. And now we have some science about it, because when we put the stickers on our forehead and measure the electricity in EEG, much like a sticker on your chest would measure the electrical activity of the nerves on the surface of the heart. It's not about the muscle, it's the nerves on the surface of the heart. That shows that awake brain waves, or we have electrical storms in our mind, it's not wires. It's more like aurora borealis and swarm of birds, how they fly. It's not linear. That those awake brain waves and the asleep brain waves, which are always distinct, in those windows before you fall asleep and when you are waking up, they overlap a little bit. So then you add a little bit of scientific explanation to it. Not the complete story, but there should be at least one step further when people say, this could help you, your brain. Ask to have it explained by one step further. And so that's my best approach to creativity.
Absolutely fascinating. So much in this book, and just such a worthwhile read. Dr. Rahul Jandial, thank you so much. This was a fascinating discussion. The book is called Life Lessons from a Brain Surgeon, The New Science and Stories of the Brain, and it's published by Penguin Life. It's out now. You've been listening to Monocle Reads, thanks to the production team of Nora Hull and Giacomo Harper. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.